Hello, brothers and sisters of comic book land. Welcome to the real Short Box. My name is Kevin.
I'm Donald.
I'm fucking Jarrett.
Wow.
Deal with it.
Wait, you're fucking Jarrett or you are...
Yeah, my name's Ronnie. I'm fucking Jarrett. No, I'm just Jarrett, guys. I'm sorry I was so abrasive.
That's quite an adjective, man. Yeah. Describe yourself.
That's awkward.
Yeah. Man,
I'm here. Reggie's not.
Are you saying that because you're pumped up for...
I like Reggie.
Are you saying that because you're pumped up for today's special episode?
Yeah, I'm feeling special. I'm feeling valiant.
Yes.
Did that work at all?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, why not?
We're doing another one of those comic book publisher history episodes, and today, indeed, we're doing the history of Valiant Comics.
Mm-hmm. And how.
Yes, we are.
So, let's get started.
Let's get started. Now, real quick, the precursor to the beginning of Valiant Comics starts with Marvel Comics itself, with Jim Shooter, who was the editor-in-chief.
Oh. Jim Shooter McGee, Jim they called Shooter. Him.
Now, I did a lot of research about Jim Shooter.
I know you did, and I will allow you to jump into that in a moment. But just real quick, Jim Shooter was the editor-in-chief back in the late 70s through most of the 80s as well, until about 1987 when he was let go at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
He was known for being a taskmaster of a man, someone who kept things in line.
He could mimic powers of other... He could mimic abilities. He had... Photographic reflexes.
He could throw a shield
at
writers.
Just like Captain America could.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a hell of a manager, streamlined things, was responsible for many of the miniseries there, like Secret Wars. And basically, he had issues with some of the staff members. Some people just didn't like his approach, his managing style.
Mm-hmm.
So things happened behind the scenes, and he was pushed out in 1987. And then in 1989, he teamed up with Steve Masarsky, to form Voyager Communications with some German investors.
Masarsky was he was a lawyer, right? He was a business guy?
Yeah, he was a business guy. Right. And they formed Valiant Comics in 1989. Now, what's interesting real quick about Masarsky is that he had the rights to produce the Marvel live-action characters for a brief period of time for only $25,000.
Wow.
Yes.
Damn, missed the boat on that, didn't he?
He missed the boat on it because he only had the rights for so certain amount of time, but he wasn't able to get anything going, so...
Right. Well, also, the effects back then would have sucked.
It would have sucked back then.
Yeah.
And also, real quick, another interesting point was that not too long after Jim Shooter was let go, he tried to purchase Marvel Comics itself when it was auctioned off.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't work. He came in second behind Ron Perlman, who was the running Revlon.
And Hellboy.
No, that's Ron Perlman.
Yes, Ron Perlman.
All those Pearl people are the same to me.
Whoa, that's racist.
Well, Masarsky also, just real quick, he first owned, prior to the comic book business, he operated an artist management company handling artists such as the Allman Brothers, the Wailers. He's responsible for launching the career of Girls Just Want to Have Fun people, Cyndi Lauper.
Nice.
And then he next operated an entertainment law practice. I worked in an entertainment law firm for many years as an admin, and it was pretty chill, I'm not going to lie. And he had clients such as Nintendo, Cabbage Patch Dolls, the Psychedelic Furs, Aerosmith, and Willie Mays. That is a random, that is like all a spot. That's not even just like music, that's like all across the entertainment world. Kudos to you, Mr. Masarsky.
Masarsky.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to talk about the man. I thought he deserved his respect.
Oh, not a problem.
Yeah.
And I'll let Donald talk a little bit about Jim Shooter, since he's a big part of this, especially the first half of Valiant Comics history.
Yeah, a little bit about Jim Shooter. He's a big guy. He's a big guy right now, anyway.
How tall is he?
He's tall. He's really friggin' tall. He was born in 1951. He was an occasional fill-in artist, editor, and publisher for various comic books. At the age of 13, in mid-1965, he wrote and drew stories featuring the Legion of Superheroes.
Knew it, yeah.
And sent them into DC Comics. On February 10th, 1966, he received a phone call from Mort Wessinger, who wanted to purchase the stories Shooter had sent.
How old is he?
Can you imagine that? You were 13 years old when you sent these stories in, and DC's like, we like what you wrote.
That is amazing.
We'd like to purchase
these. Insane. Yeah.
Boy, I would gloat to my school friends so quickly. Like,
yeah.
Guys, guess what?
First of all, you'd think, like, nowadays, they'd probably just steal the stories and say that they never heard of you.
Yeah, pretty much.
But they were, you know, called a 13-year-old kid and was like, hey, we like your stories. We'd like to buy them from you, kid.
That's amazing. It's so sidebar. I'm reading to my daughter The Outsiders right now, written by S.E. Hinton. She wrote that when she was 15 years old and got her publishing deal on her graduation day from high school. I just like, these stories just make me feel like a fucking loser. So thank you, Jim Shooter, and thank you, Essie Hinton.
Motherfuckers.
Love your work, guys.
On February 10th, he received a phone call, as I said, and basically, he wanted to purchase his stories and commissioned Shooter to write a Supergirl and Superman story. Quite a few, actually. Wessinger eventually offered Shooter a regular position on Legion and wanted Shooter to come to New York to spend a couple of days in his office. Shooter was only 14 and lived in Pittsburgh at the time and had to wait till school was in recess, after which he went to New York with his mother, spurred in part by the need to support his family financially. I guess his father was struggling a little bit.
Wow.
His father was a steel worker, and Shooter saw comic books as a means for helping, economically speaking. All right, now we're going to jump into the Marvel section of Jim Shooter. In mid-1970s, Marvel Comics was undergoing a series of changes in the position of editor-in-chief. Roy Thomas stepped down from the post to focus on writing, and a succession of editors, including Len Wein, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, and Archie Goodwin, took the job during a relatively short span of time, only to find the task too daunting as Marvel continued to grow and add new titles and a larger staff to turn out material. On January 2nd, 1976, guys, Shooter joined the Marvel staff as an assistant editor and writer. With the quick turnover at the top, Shooter rapidly found himself rising in the ranks and in 1978 succeeded Archie Goodwin to become Marvel's ninth editor-in-chief.
Mm-hmm.
During this period, publisher Stan Lee relocated to Los Angeles to better oversee Marvel's animation, television, and film projects, leaving Shooter largely in charge of the creative decision-making at Marvel's new York City headquarters. Although there were complaints among some of the that Shooter imposed a dictatorial style on the bullpen, he cured many of the procedural ills at Marvel, successfully managing to keep a line of books on schedule, which was a big problem for Marvel at the time. He added new titles and developed new talent. During that run, Marvel enjoyed some of its best successes. Chris Claremont, John Byrne, they did a run on Uncanny X-Men. Byrne's work on Fantastic Four. Frank Miller did his Daredevil run.
Mm-hmm.
Walt Simonson did the Norse mythology and Thor. Roger Stern did the Avengers and the Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Some big things.
And he kept them all on schedule.
He kept them on schedule. And what he really, I think, I remember reading about that he really hammered home was all the books. It was the Marvel Universe. So he wanted all the books, no matter what book you were reading, to feel cohesive with the other one. So if something happened in a Marvel team-up with the Beast, and then, say, an X-Men issue came out a month later, that might have referenced that Marvel team-up story. So it's like there was a real history and timeline going on.
And it wreaked havoc with the writers, because they had to go in and be like, okay, so I have to reference something somebody else did.
Where is so-and-so left off?
Oh, this is ridiculous. I just want to write what I want to write, and why can't I... You know, and that created a bit of an issue because Shooter saw it from a reader's standpoint and not from a writer. And the writer felt stymied. They felt like they were constricted because they didn't have the open format, the open flow that they would normally have.
Mm-hmm.
So you think someone like Chris Claremont was probably had a hissy fit?
I don't know so much Chris Claremont because he was kind of brought on during that Shooter era. He might have appreciated that more. Oh. And also, he did a huge run. So if he didn't like it,
he would have left a long time ago. Okay.
Yeah, DC would have poached him for sure.
Yeah.
In 1981, Shooter brought Marvel into the lucrative comic book specialty shop market with Dazzler number 1.
Yes. I almost bought that the other day.
Yeah,
I did get it pretty cheap.
Why didn't you?
Because I'll grab it when I want
to. Yeah, it features a disco-themed heroine with ties to the X-Men based upon an unproduced motion picture set to star Bo Derek.
Wow.
Yeah, how about that?
Oh, I'd love for them to go back in time and make a Bo Derek Dazzler movie.
That would have been cool.
The first issue of this series was sold only through specialty stores, bypassing the then-standard newsstand spin rack distribution route altogether, as a recognition by Marvel of the growing comic shop sector.
It's a pretty glam cover, too. It's like, it's almost like that looks like a real person kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool. And all the other issues after that were done in newsstand, but Dazzler was the first direct sales-only ongoing series from a major publisher. Other Marvel titles, such as Marvel Fanfare, Kazar, you know, things like that soon followed under that realm of that type of sales. Now we're going to get into the Valiant Shooter and his investors, of course, you said, they got together and they published comics under Valiant Comics banner. They entered the market in 1989 with comics based on Nintendo and WWF licensed characters.
That's right.
In fact, I bought one of those. It was a Super Mario Brothers comic from Valiant. I still have it somewhere.
Is this it right here? This one?
No, it was a different one.
A different one?
Oh, yeah, okay. Different issue. But that's definitely the same series. 2 years later, Valiant entered the superhero market with a relaunch of the Gold Key Comics characters. These were big ones, guys. Magnus Robot Fighter. Shooter brought many of Marvel's creators to Valiant, including Bob Layton, mm-hmm. Barry Windsor Smith, as well as industry veterans such as Don Perlin. Valiant also established Knob Row, taking in raw talent and teaching them how to make comics Valiant style.
Right.
They launched many careers, most notably Joe Quesada.
That guy went and did like a stint at Marvel, right?
He's now the editor-in-chief, I believe.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That's what I meant.
How about that, huh? Occasionally over the years, Shooter was required to fill in as penciler in various books, and he wrote and oversaw as editor. During his period as Valiant's publisher, money and talent were often at a premium, and Shooter was sporadically forced to pencil a story. To conceal this fact, he drew under the pseudonym of Paul Kretik, which is the name of his brother-in-law.
Wait, somebody right now is like, Paul Kretik was my favorite artist.
It was Jim Shooter.
It was Jim Shooter?
He was ousted from Valiant in 1992, a company he helped found. Him and several of his co-workers went on to found Defiant Comics in early 1993. Despite some initial success with the first title, the new company failed to secure an audience in the increasingly crowded direct sales market, and they folded after 13 months of publishing. In fact, I have that first comic book that they're talking about.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It wasn't very great. In 1995, Shooter founded Broadway Comics, which was an offshoot of Broadway Video, the production company that produces Saturday Night Live.
Yes, naturally.
But the line folded after its parent company sold the properties to Golden Books.
Fuck.
Yeah, and this is like, he just keeps bouncing back and forth. In 2009, in 2007, actually, he worked for DC and he wrote Legion of Superheroes again.
That's right, that's
yeah,
right.
And I actually, that was the first time I ever was interested in Legion of Superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good when Jim Shooter, I thought, when he wrote
How weird is that, writing it when you're 13 and then writing it and you're probably like, what is he, 50s at that point?
Yeah,
there?
50s at that point, I think. Yeah, Jesus. Crazy. In 2009, Dark Horse Comics announced at the San Diego Comic-Con International that Shooter would oversee the publication of new series based on Gold Key Comic characters. Turok, Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom,
Wait,
Magnus
so Dark
Robot
Horse
Fighter.
Got the rights to those characters?
Yeah, because they're Gold Key Comic characters.
Right.
And they're licensed, so they could purchase the rights over, you know,
right.
And Valiant at that point.
Debunked.
They were defunct. And,
debunked. They were debunked for their conspiracy theories about Valiant Comics, which we'll get into.
But Valiant Comics then tried to sue, saying that they were going to try to get the Gold Key characters, but because Shooter said he was involved, they gave the rights over to Dark Horse instead. So they tried to sue Shooter for that. I don't know how that worked out as far as them trying to do that, but it didn't work out, period.
Right.
They ended up just, dropping the lawsuit.
Real quick, did you guys ever play Turok the Dinosaur Hunter on, was it Super
yeah,
Nintendo?
I did.
Such a fun fucking game.
Yes, it was.
I remember I found like a cheat code and I got like all the guns and like one of the guns just like blew up the whole screen.
Yeah.
I was like, this is fucking awesome.
It was a fun game. I think they made one or two more later for like another system or something, but they should bring that back, actually.
It was awesome. And it was like first person point of view.
Yeah, it'd be cool if they did that with Magnus too. Like fighting robots and
shit. Yeah.
That would be awesome in a futuristic world.
Especially with all the VR stuff now, too.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, probably depends. It might be tied to some legal mumbo jumbo, you know, because Acclaim Entertainment had the rights to that before they got sold off.
Yeah, but I have the rights to dinosaurs.
Do you now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. If anybody ever wants to use dinosaurs in a film, I'm crazy rich.
I thought Michael Crichton would probably have that.
Crazy rich. No, Crichton asked me.
Oh, okay. All right.
I charge $5 a dinosaur. And
that's not bad.
I'm not a good businessman.
Apparently not.
Trademark dinosaurs.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's my whole Shooter thing. I'm sorry I went off on a little tangent there. But
no, it's interesting.
That's okay.
It's an interesting day.
Do you want to ask some of this, Jared, before I continue the history?
No. Go ahead.
Okay. You probably jump in when I go through some of the other heroes that Valiant came up with in the early 90s. And as you mentioned, right after the Nintendo and WWF deals, They had the characters Exo Manowar, Harbinger. You already mentioned Ragnar's Robot Fighter. Shadow Man, which I know is something that's deep to Jared's heart.
I do have a little bit something about Shadow Man.
Okay.
Actually, just a quick little brief history of the character. I thought it was interesting. Jack Boniface is a... He's the character of Shadow Man. He's playing a saxophone for a packed jazz bar deep in the heart of New Orleans one night. A successful musician and hopeless romantic, Jack dreams of a record deal, but until then is happy to realize that a beautiful woman named Lydia has been coming to the bar every night to watch him play. That night, they leave the bar together. Ooh la la. They go to her residence, where Jack consumes a drugged drink and falls unconscious, believing this is his last moment on Earth. In the morning, he wakes to find Lydia gone and a strange mark on his chest. Later that night, Jack stalks the streets, compelled by an urge to hunt Lydia down and take revenge.
Jesus.
Yeah. He finds a discarded carnival mask on the street and inexplicably is drawn to it. He picks it up and hears the cries of a woman being assaulted in the back alley. Now, not because he's put on the mask, but he just hears it coincidentally. He confronts the attacker and finds that he has superhuman strength and speed, with which he's able to frighten the attacker into fleeing. Jack's housekeeper, Nettie, who happens to be a voodoo practitioner, of course, senses the change in Jack. She explains that something evil in the night ripped open the doorway to his soul. Now whenever shadows fall, his soul comes out, takes over, and goes hunting. She tells him in voodoo talk, "Shadow means soul. You the shadow man." Nettie feels the presence of a Loa, or spirit, named Basu Koblamin in Jack. Basu has become Jack's Metete, the Loa who stands for him. Nettie tells him that
although... Know your voodoo history, people.
I know, I'm trying here, guys. Nettie tells him that although ignorant people think Basu is evil, in truth Basu embodies a rage against evil and is not possessing Jack, but helping him. So, Nettie, feeling that Jack's newborn nighttime identity of Shadow Man is part of his destiny, makes Jack an outfit for his new identity, which bears the image of his soul stepping out and three spikes of light piercing the darkness, just like Basso's three horns. Putting on the mask, Jack roams the streets and confronts violent criminals. So that's Shadow Man in a nutshell.
You know, just your basic... That's the thing about the Valiant stories, is they're all, like, very convoluted, because they were either old characters...
Yeah.
Or even, like I'm looking at Rai, was, like, this hardcore, like, futuristic Japanese... Was it Japanese, I think? Take on, like, the future of Japan. I mean, it goes, like... hardcore in depth.
Did you ever pick up that issue Zero back in the day?
No, which is what Valiant is one of the first to start.
Yes.
The Zero books.
Yes.
Which now are kind of common, but...
Yeah, thanks to Marvel.
Yeah, thanks to Marvel, but like... it was always... I remember for me, it was always like... Not just in Valiant, but like in any comic, it was always like, wait, did the Zero come first? Or did... Because they usually came like right after. Or sometimes they came before.
Well, with Zero Hour with DC, they rebooted their entire line and every issue started with Zero.
Like, I was just looking at the old Starman, James Robinson Starman, started with Zero. Like, actually did start with Zero.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And yeah, so they were... Valiant was definitely on the cutting edge of marketing comics, of like...
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to say the word in a negative way, but exploiting some things, you know, as far as like the Zero. Like, what's another way to get cash? Hey, we have a number one. Let's have a number zero.
Gold and silver cardstock covers embossed.
Oh my God, they were huge in that.
Yeah, they did that. They had, I think they had a Leninger or something similar to a Leninger.
Particular or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Something like that. Something similar to
now,
that.
Let me ask you guys, when Valiant hit the scene, this was, early 90s. So we had kind of pre, was it pre-image or like?
Pre-image, but they kind of started exploding on the scene around the same time.
Right.
Yeah, very close.
Were
very
you guys... I know where I was at. Were you guys Valiant collectors?
A couple here. A little bit.
I bought them. I never read them. I'm going to be honest. But I bought them. I bought them like crazy.
Really?
You did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because, like, again, my comic shop had the 10-cent box.
Oh, okay.
And when books didn't sell, they'd throw them in there.
So you scoop them out of
there. So, I would just scoop up issue after issue out of that 10-cent box.
Never did.
See, for me...
No.
Nope. They just never got... They never pulled me in. I don't... Exo Manowar looked cool. The only one that looked cool was... What was it? Deadshot? Not Deadshot.
Bloodshot.
Yeah, Bloodshot was pretty cool.
He looked cool, but I literally bought... That was the only book I bought, and that was just because he looked cool. And I never read it.
Yeah. Who was the one I got? It was the guy that would Mirage, I think, was his character's name, if I'm correct.
Okay.
And he would he was like a dream character. Like he would dream, and the hero would form out of him. He was like I don't know if he was Chinese or Japanese or something, but he was I will say that Valiant was very ethnically diverse.
Yes, matter of fact, were known for that back then.
Yeah, very, very, which was cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't go, oh my God, there's somebody I don't recognize in the mirror on the cover. I didn't care. I just thought I bought a lot of these issues because they looked cool.
Right.
Like the Bloodshot one, I think the zero issue, if mm-hmm. I recall, had that amazing gold foil background.
Everything was shiny. Yeah,
yeah, it was so shiny cool.
But I remember looking at characters and they might have been great, but as a kid, I remember going Archer and Armstrong. This just looks like two homeless people. What is this book?
Yeah. Also, Eternal Warrior, which Frank Miller did some art for initially.
That's right, Eternal Warrior. Right.
That's true, yeah.
And speaking of the zero issues, when you guys talking about that, do you remember they did this 18-part mega crossover called Unity, where they introduce Archer and Armstrong mm-hmm. and Eternal Warrior? So that was a big thing back then, almost a way to compete with DC and Marvel's big crossovers.
And again, this is the guy that created the crossover.
That's right.
Going in, creating, building a whole universe, and then creating a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Spectacular work.
Yep. Him and Bob Layton did most of the work, I would say.
Yeah.
They're like the, the brains behind, the operations, so to
speak.
Yeah,
Layton left with him.
Layton left with him, really?
Yeah, because I think he was
in
Marvel.
They left Marvel together, yes.
Yeah.
A lot of that happening. Also, at the end of that Unity crossover was the creation of, we were saying, Bloodshot, Ninjak, who we've talked about before, Hardcorpse, the second life of Dr. Mirage.
That's it, second life,
And Time Walker was another one, which I've never heard of.
I don't remember Time Walker. Yeah. That must have been near the end.
Ninjak, I remember.
I know the second life of Dr. Mirage was near the end, too, if I recall. Then it didn't last too long. Then they did something else, right? Like a Death Something or whatever.
Deathmate.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's it.
Which was with Image, right?
Yeah, so it was crossover Image. And interestingly enough, also some people who were sick of Marvel decided to leave and start their own company. But they had a slightly different way of going about things, where Valiant was trying to be a traditional company with a shared universe. Image was multiple companies were kind of like a confederation,
Well, Image was also all about talent.
Yeah, so it was pure talent. Valiant artists, all the artists.
Right.
Jim Shooter was actually an executive, a manager who knew how to bring things together.
Valiant was a new business starting and then bringing in the talent.
Yes.
Image was the talent and then forming the business off the talent.
And then bringing their friends in who were talent and working with them or under them.
Yeah, and it was an interesting mix. You can see the stark differences.
Yes.
Especially in the characterizations and stuff when you read. And if you look at Deathmate came in what? That was a money grab. They came in how many different colors? It was a foil cover, mm-hmm. and they had one that was red.
Red, black, blue, and yellow.
Yeah, that's right. And then they made a rare gold one, I believe, if I recall.
I just remember covers. It was XO Manowar and the Wildcats, and it was everybody was just mixed together, and don't remember the story at all. That was another one I bought just because I was cool, they're crossing over.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the purpose was because Solar would meet and fall in love with Void from Wildcast, and that's where all this started. The relationship
would
cause reality to reform and create a single universe. So there's supposed to have been 6 parts to it. And of course, the issues that, as you know, back during that time in the early 90s, books weren't coming out on time. Mm-hmm. And on this end, it was really mostly Image's fault.
Oh, I'm sure it was Image's fault. Shooter was losing his shit.
Yeah, it was mostly Image's fault. So this kind of hurt the whole venture. And plus, they didn't do a good job of communicating with each other, so they understood which, the characterizations, how to do the characters properly, study the characters.
Right, whenever Image would come together as a group, all their characters, they're notorious for never finishing anything.
Like Image United.
Yeah, which or a darker Image, I believe,
too. We're probably 70 years old by the time we see the end of that.
The only good crossover Image story I remember liking, and I was actually probably the most I was ever into Image, was Extreme Prejudice. Because they actually really had a history of, they had everybody, Prophet was a big part of it, Supreme.
Prophet.
I think Youngblood, Brigade. They actually really made it, it was the most streamlined story. Prophet came in issue number 2 of Youngblood. He was purple,
right.
He was this big warrior dude.
He was Liefeld creation, if I recall. Then Moon Knight, back in the 90s, Moon Knight, nobody cared anything about Moon Knight. And then this new artist started writing with issue number 55, I believe. It was Stephen Platt.
Right. Yeah.
And the artwork was like something no one's ever seen. And mm-hmm. everybody just lost their shit and went out to find this issue. In fact, I saw it. And I think I called Kevin or texted him or something at the time. And I said, they want $100 for Moon Knight number 55 for the first Stephen Platt.
No problem.
And I was just laughing because it's like at best a $20 book at best. Because it's just the, you know, it's just the art for a guy that's no longer in the business, really. You don't hear anything about him. But he was so hot that Liefeld got him
to do profit.
To do profit. Right. And launch that. That book.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that's interesting about this particular crossover series is that the issues were going for $4.95. I almost forgot about that.
Yeah, that's pricey.
I mean, Holy shit, back then.
Shit, right.
Now, imagine us as kids.
To pay for our cardstock.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine us kids. Like you can only buy like one book per week or something like that. Yeah. You're like, no way you're going to buy it. $4.95?
I could get 3 X-Men books for this motherfucker.
Exactly.
And I said motherfuckers then because that was the 90s.
And this book was representative and a metaphor for what was going on during that period of time. This was kind of like the end of the comics boom. Like, speculators were starting to get out because a lot of people were buying, as you know, different books and hoping it's going to be worth $1 million down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And
so dumb.
Yeah. Yep. And then on top of that, like we talked before, books are coming in late from publishers, pissing people off. So mm-hmm.
Valiant was like the, Valiant was like the opposite of all that because of Shooter's influence on all that. Valiant had so much product coming out.
Yeah, in the initial beginning, they were just on top of things, especially when Jim Shooter was in charge. Yes, everything was...
And to this day, to this fucking day, and I know you guys know this, when you go to like a 50-cent bin, like a quarter bin that they still have, riddled with Valiant comics.
Yes.
Still to this day, like I've never seen so many overproduced, like, you can't give Valiant comics away. Like, the original stuff.
Like, if you order something off eBay, sometimes they'll throw in a free Valiant comic. I'll wipe my ass with that. Thanks. Yeah. But something happened, right, to Valiant? Like, what was the big thing that, like, Acclaim, it changed over or something at some point?
Yes, not too long after Jim Shooter was fired and Bob Layton took over as editor-in-chief.
Do we know why Shooter was fired?
There have been so many reasons. Some say, you know, the investor group, you know, they wanted to kind of like take his shares away for themselves. You know, they were looking at this as the peak.
The power. Probably that's it. It had to do with the fact that the boon, you know, the bubble had burst. They were scrambling, trying to figure out any way to keep the company afloat.
Right.
And then profit from it so they could leave and just let everything fall.
Yeah, because aside from Shooter and Mazarsky, it was just investors.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you have to understand, these were venture capitalists. They're just looking in to come in, make a little bit of money, and then get out. They weren't really as serious about the long-term pitch that Jim Shooter had. Hey, I want this to last for decades.
Right.
They weren't really looking at it that way. So they had to, you know, do what they do, conspire, and
it was another business, like what you're saying, another business. So Valiant was all under Voyager Communications. That was like their company underneath Valiant. So in 1994, that's when Acclaim Entertainment purchased them.
$65 million.
Right. So
wow, that's huge.
And
that's
Acclaim was smart, though, because they were using it as a way to create, because they were a video game company.
That's right. They were using it to create
A number of video games based on the Valiant properties. They did a Shadow Man one, Turok the Dinosaur Hunters, we just talked about, Armorines, Swarm.
Heavy Metal.
They didn't, this one, do you remember that? Yeah, Heavy Metal. They did an Iron Man and Exo Manowar video game. So I
together?
Don't know how, yeah, I don't know how they did that one.
Wow.
But yeah, which featured Valiant's Exo Manowar alongside Marvel's Iron Man.
I don't know that one at all, but I want to play it.
Yeah. In 2000.
I'm going to ask Louie if he has it. My friend Louie, our pal Louie.
Good chance.
Louie, you know who you are. He has a bunch of these like random video games. He keeps like, oh, do you remember this game or that game? And I'd be like, no. And he's like, I have it.
There's like super obscure ones. Do you have the Goonies 2 video game on Nintendo?
Yeah, if you have the obscure Exo Iron Man one, please let me know because I'd love to play it.
I think I remember seeing it. It was like the tail end of Super Nintendo. It was like the end of the line kind of thing. And they're like, throw out these Acclaim games.
Right. Writing was on the wall at that point. But they also did, if I'm correct, they did like Sliders, property based off the television
show.
That sounds
yeah,
familiar.
They did. I think that was Acclaim that did that. They did a bunch of miniseries about them.
Right.
Which I thought was really cool. You know, it was like that was around the time when Topps Comics existed.
Tops.
And Topps got the
Everybody
rights
just
to...
Everybody just trying to cash in on shit. That's what it was. It was just
Topps
a
got
cash
the
in.
Rights to X-Files, and they were doing that. And then Mars Attacks and a few other properties. Some of the Jack Kirby old ones, like Bombast and Night Glider or whatever the hell they were called.
Right.
You know, some of the ridiculous ones that no one wanted. Top's got.
What's crazy is we were talking about the Golden Key characters. How many times the rights to, like, several of these characters passed around to different companies?
Oh, yeah. I think the Mighty Samson is still with Dynamite, if I'm correct.
Well, and DreamWorks Animation bought some of this stuff in 2012, and I don't even know if they still have it anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that would be cool if DreamWorks went out with, like, a Magnus Robot Fighter type thing or something, you know?
Right.
A little more adult-like animated version.
And yes, and as time continued during this period of time, the comic book boom had ended, things were going to hell, and Acclaim had bought Valiant, and then they decided to reboot the series and change the characters drastically to a point where they just eliminated the name, became Acclaim Comics. But they're always just trying to milk those characters for the video game properties. That's what it's really all about. They weren't really doing much.
They didn't care about the comics.
Yeah,
because
not
even
so much.
Even Turok was, like I was saying, such a fun game, but there was no story in it. It was just literally you went around in prehistoric times as Turok fighting dinosaurs. I mean, that was literally it. You just fought dinosaurs and slashed them up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, I got a cool key trivia for you that Donald will enjoy. In 1996, guess who the editor-in-chief was of Acclaim Comics?
No clue.
Fabian Nicieza.
Son of a bitch! No wonder
Donald's
they went under.
Arch nemesis.
No wonder they went under.
Fabian
Nicieza. He gave some new backstories to all the characters.
Yeah,
X-Men
just ruined
War,
them. Ruined them
Bloodshot,
all.
Shadow Man,
what a
Ninja,
surprise.
To make them more video game friendly.
Oh, motherfucker. Sell out, sell out, sell out.
Now, who do you, I mean, obviously.
Son of a bitch, I knew it.
But interestingly enough, he did go out of his way to find the best talent to work on this bastardized version. He went and got Mark Waid, Garth Ennis, and Kurt Busiek to work on X-Men of War, Shadow Man, and Ninjak during that time. But of course, they weren't sticking to the original versions of the characters.
Did you say Garth Ennis?
Yes, Garth Ennis.
Wow. That's
yes, sir.
Crazy.
Now you like him, huh?
No, now I'm like, what the f-? No, I'm sure these are all paychecks. These are straight up paychecks.
Oh, yeah. Some people were getting paid pretty good, actually.
No, these are straight up paychecks.
Acclaim was actually pretty good about that. Acclaim actually did pay, you know, people to come in. Matter of fact, give me back. Give me a second. Let me go
Quantum
back.
And Woody. I forgot about
Quantum
them.
And Quantum and Woody.
Yeah.
Now, wait, I got it. While you're looking,
they're making
at
a movie, I think, out of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, or a TV series, something. One
matter
other.
Of fact, here, perfect example: John Ostrander,
Suicide Squad,
among others, alum. Was paid $20,000 an issue.
What the fuck?
Whoa!
Yes,
that's insanity.
He worked on Eternal Warrior, and he was getting paid 20 G's an issue.
That's crazy.
That's insane.
What?
Dan Jurgens worked on Solar. Ron Mars worked on X-Mana Wars. So these guys were getting paid. So Acclaim,
they had video game money. That's what
yep,
it was.
That's why.
And totally they were just
it.
We'll pay
you know what? It'd be similar to like if Snapchat or Facebook wanted to buy a comic book company and they were just wanting to say, hey, you know, we really like these characters, but we want to use it for our products. But you know, we'll pay you like $1 million.
Yeah,
to,
it's an app where we outline your penis and we're gonna call it Shadow Man.
Yeah,
here, check this out. You want to cut up some lines on this Nintendo cartridge? Yeah, that's right. Video game money, motherfuckers.
Right.
Pretty much.
Now I got just a what if for you. I know how you feel about Fabian, and I'm not shocked or whatever. But and I think I know the answer. But who do you hate more, Fabian Nicieza or Scott Lobdell?
Uh-oh.
Fabian.
Really?
Hands down.
Hands down?
Hands down. Scott did write a decent Blue Beetle issue recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah, decent. I'm not saying great, but it had Ted Kord in it. He was like the lead.
Pulled on your heartstrings.
And yeah, pulled on my heartstrings. So it was like, I think it was like two issues or something, but he did write it and I was like scared. I was like, this is going to be total shit. And it wasn't total shit.
Right.
So I'll give him credit. If Fabian had written it, it probably would have starred Yaimi and 30 other people that he would introduce in that issue and would have no backstory or reference to the goddamn thing. And you'd be lost when you were trying to read it and it would suck. Just saying.
Sorry, Fabian. This guy's got a real fucking mat on for
See,
you.
See, I knew I would get you going when I told you that he was one of the editors,
Son
chiefs
of a
at the time.
Bitch.
So let's streamline this. So where does Valiant go and where are they now?
Well, you know, things in the 90s, as we just talked about, weren't going so well. So after a while, Acclaim was having its financial trouble.
Now 20,000 an issue, I could see why.
Yeah.
So around 2004, they filed for bankruptcy. And then in 2005, two young entrepreneurs named Devesh...
Well... let's be honest though. In 2004, when they filed for bankruptcy, they had stopped producing comics.
Yes, that's true. That. Oh yeah, they stopped like producing years. Yeah, they stopped producing about 4 or 5 years before.
Because comic shop owners were like, my 25-cent bins are fucking overflowing with your comic books, and matter of nobody fact, wants them. Valiant.
Matter of fact, that's a lot of truth to that. And along with the other companies back then, you know, if you bought the books, that's it. There was no refunds. So. Matter of fact, that Deathmate series was a huge reason why, unfortunately, a lot of the comic shops went under, because you got all this excess.
And that's $5 a
and
book.
Kids
even discount.
And they ain't buying it. And they ain't buying it. So, of course, you're doomed.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, it's a wrap. But later on, back in 2004, they filed for bankruptcy. In 2005, two entrepreneurs named Jason Kathari and Dinesh Shamdasani, they won an auction to the Valiant Comics library.
They won an auction for
yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Interesting enough.
And the funny thing is, there was some weird legal thing going on where another company called Valiant Intellectual Properties LLC was trying to get the trademark rights to the Valiant title. So they had to go at it in court for a couple years until they finally resolved it in 2007.
Right.
And then, of course, later on in 2012, they finally relaunched many of the favorite titles like X-Man of War, Archer, and Armstrong. I remember we talked about this in private about how much excited we were. We actually liked the way the new direction they're gone.
Right.
Even brought Jim Shooter back briefly. And so once again, he was booted again
for
some
Jim.
Reason.
Poor Jim.
Hey, that guy's been working steady since he was 13
right.
years old.
By the way, Jim, if you ever want to come on the show, please, you're more than welcome.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear your side of the story.
We'll let you say your piece and then we'll boot you. I'm kidding. You can stay and have beers.
Yeah, you could.
Well, first of all, he's a big dude. He'd probably crush your little head.
He'd be like, "I'll boot you."
Strangle us with his ponytail.
But it's my place.
You know what though is interesting though, just kind of like as we've been doing these histories, the companies where the story and the artists and the talent actually, you know, a lot of times you know we're in Los Angeles where everything's a business. And you always get, like, talent is secondary. And most of the time, it is. But I will always say talent is what sustains you.
Absolutely.
So you might get that in.
And not just artistic talent, but also executive management talent.
Oh, completely. Across the board.
Across the board.
But I look at companies like Image, and we talked about Dark Horse. That's why these companies lasted. Because at the end of it all, yes, they had the wherewithal to kind of branch out. And they took the risk. But at the end of it all, they had the talent. You know, whether it was the talent that was they brought in or that came in, you know, for instance, with Image, like a Robert Kirkman, that they kept the doors open for talent, you know, where, you know, Marvel and DC have all that kind of built in talent or these old timers that are still around, you know, but it's not a place that you look to for the new anymore. You know what
right.
I'm saying?
Yeah. No. In fact, Marvel, DC usually get the creators, a lot of them actually, from Image Comics.
Exactly.
We'll go over then to Marvel DC because they liked those characters. They grew up with them and they want to try their hand at them.
Right.
But their bread and butter is in the creations that they've made.
Right.
Yep.
Which is always nice.
Yep.
You know?
Danny Deal and Joe Quesada, they're only going to go so far.
Yep.
Right.
But I think that's it, right? For the whole Valiant universe?
Yeah, I guess that says it all in a nutshell. You know, Valiant, you know, they've been resurrected. They are still out there. They're doing pretty good. You know, you can't complain.
Well, it was a Valiant effort.
A Valiant effort. And also, as we know, they have greenlit a few projects for...
The Ninjak web series thing.
It's going to be a web series, really?
Oh, yeah. It's from Bat and the Sun, those guys that do the...
Okay.
Yeah. And, which, by the way, Friends of the Blue Beetle, Ted Kord returns.
Yeah?
Yeah. Met one of the guys. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
You gotta pick up that name I just dropped.
Get it off the floor.
Yep. Anyway, with that, please, subscribe. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, iTunes, YouTube.
Let your family and friends know.
MySpace. I don't think we're on that.
No, we're not on MySpace. But you know where we are? We're at the comic shops, and we'll see.